somehow shape the future. I would hope and pray I'd touch lives by the way I live today. I want to leave a legacy of a sermon to believe the world could be changed by just one life. That I live only for the cause of Christ. Oh, to make a difference by living day to day as a reflection of God. Oh, God. I want to leave a legacy
everyone. This is Steve Donahue with another episode of the Legacy Podcast, equipping you to build your legacy. This episode is going to be 224, and it is a recording of a message that I recently preached to the church in which I pastor, Mount Tabor Baptist Church, from Esther chapter 2. It's the continuation of our expositional series through Esther 2, and in this passage, you will be able to first be acquainted with Esther, as well as Mordecai. And the textual outline for the passage itself is the problem, the plan, the people, and that, of course, is where you're introduced to Mordecai and Esther, the preparations, the presentation, the promotion, and the plan. You can see that outline, as well as some of the implications of the passage, on the webpage itself under the show notes, which is 224. But before you actually hear the exposition, I want to take care of a little bit of business and mention a few resources. First of all, if you're not a registered user yet, I want to encourage you to do that. That way you can find out when there are new shows out and anything that I post on whether it be a podcast or an actual written post or anything like that, you will be notified through email. That enables you to do that. If you've not yet subscribed through our iTunes feed, I encourage you to do that. And if you like the show and you want to be a supporter of the show, the best way of doing that is through the Legacy Partner Program. Also, if you have not yet gone over to thehomeschoolhope.com and checked out that new podcast that I have over there, I encourage you to do that. And then finally, if you want to support the show by using any of the affiliates, you'll see a link in the show notes to the affiliates, as well as on the center right column of the webpage itself. There is banners for each of them. And, of course, for no extra cost to you, by shopping at those places, you will be able to help support the show. Thank you all for listening, and thank you all for your support and for passing on the word to others. So stay tuned now for this exposition of Esther chapter 2. There have been a great deal of Cinderella movies that have come out of Hollywood of recent, and as you might imagine, Mary likes them all. And so we've had to watch several of them on Netflix and through video and other means, and they're all basically the same story. It's Cinderella revisited in some way or another, and the reason why they're such popular movies is, why not? They're always about this humble little girl that ends up being attracted to the prince or the king, and he falls in love with her, and they get married, and they live happily ever after. What a great story. And sometimes, because that is such a great story, we want that to be reality. And when we read the book of Esther, I think sometimes we impose upon it what is not there. And sometimes I have heard very often Esther preached as though it is this fairy tale of love story, where the young Jewish virgin girl falls in love with the king of Persia. He marries her and they live happily ever after, and she becomes a heroine for her people. That's probably the way you've heard it in Sunday school. But the reality is that's not very close to what actually takes place in the book of Esther. It's much more complicated than that. The decisions that are made are not as black and white as we would think. And so we're going to look in chapter 2 because in it there is a great deal of details, I think, that we must not miss. Now, the storyline is pretty simple. The storyline follows this pattern. There is the problem in verse 1. There is the plan in verse 2 and 4. And then the people are introduced, the main characters, in verses 5 through 7. Preparations are made to solve the problem in verses 8 through 11. The presentation of the possible queens is in verses 12 through 14. Esther is promoted in 15 through 18. And then there is a plot that is discovered in verses 19 through 23. And so it's a pretty simple storyline. And what I'm going to do is just kind of go through that story and weave in it a couple of lessons that can be found throughout it, and then conclude with, I think, the most important lesson that we can glean from these passages. And so what is the problem? Well, we identify the problem in verse 1. It says, "After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her." It says, "After these things." Now, between chapter 1 and chapter 2, there was about 3 years or 2 or 3 year period interval that took place that we are not, we don't have any identification in the Old Testament about that. But exterior sources from the Bible tell us that during this period of time, Ahasuerus waged a war against Greece. And he took his army over to Greece and fought against many of the Greek city-states, particularly led by King Leonidas of Sparta, and he was defeated pretty decisively at the Battle of Thermopylae, very famous battle in ancient history. And so if you can picture yourself in Ahasuerus' place, he was the ruler of the greatest empire at the time, has this big party, rejects Vashti because she doesn't come to him when he requests it, kicks her out, and then he goes off to war for 2 or 3 years, fails in his attempt to destroy the Greek world, and then comes back with his tail tucked between his legs, depressed, saddened, and defeated as a king. Now, most likely, the way that I picture it is he comes back into his chamber, and he's lonely. And he thinks to himself, "Sure would be nice to have a wife to hold right now." And then he remembers what he did. And he regrets the decision that he made. And he says, "This is no good." And of course, the people around him see the challenge that he is in, and they come up with a plan. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But I think that there is a lesson, even in verse 1, for us to be reminded of, and that is that pride closes doors to restored relationships. Now, we know that he had already commanded from the laws of the Medes and the Persians that Vashti was no longer to come into his presence. She was dethroned as queen and no longer allowed in his presence. But I can't help but think that there must have been some other way for him to be able to pass another law that would allow him to restore his queen to some measure of prominence in his life. And yet I think that the reason why he didn't is because of pride. You see, in front of all the people, all of his dignitaries, if you remember from chapter 1, he had all of his nobles and all of his governors together when he commanded Vashti to come into the room. She didn't come into the room, and he was embarrassed. So he asked the advisors around him, "What do we do? What does the law say?" They, of course, advise him and say, "You need to get rid of her and get a new queen. What's going to happen if all the women rebel like she did? It's going to be an uproar." And so, in his drunken stupor, he decides to go ahead and pass that law and to get rid of his queen. Now, mind you, at this time, at the time of chapter 1, she was pregnant with his child. He goes off to war, comes back, she's not able to be in his presence,
He hasn't even seen his son. And he's lonely. And he's saddened. And he regrets. And I wonder how many of us can look at our past decisions and be in a similar state because of our pride. We're unwilling to make any changes. I wonder how many politicians there are who make decisions, and then rather than saying, you know, that was a bad decision, that was a mistake on my part, we need to change that. Instead, they continue to press on the same course because of pride. I wonder how many marriages fall apart and do not get back together because of pride. Where people say, well, you know, I that's the course that I chose, and done is done, and we can't look back now. Rather than humbling themselves and restoring the relationship. What about relationships between friends? How many have let relationships dissolve because of pride? Well, unless that person apologizes, I'm just not going to talk to them anymore. It's pride. Proverbs chapter 15, verse 33 says, "The fear of the Lord is the instruction of wisdom, and before honor is humility." Proverbs 18, verse 12 says, "Before destruction the heart of man is haughty, and before honor is humility." Proverbs 22, verse 4 says, "By humility and the fear of the Lord are riches and honor and life." I pray that through the example that we see of Ahasuerus here in his pride, it would be a conviction for us, if there is pride in our life that has prevented the restoration of a relationship, that we would put that pride aside. Secondly, we see in verse 2 the beginning of their plan. So they see here that his situation is desperate. He's lonely. The king can't be lonely. He's despondent because he has been defeated in battle, and now he is wanting some comfort. Some encouragement. So in verse 2, what does it say? "Then the king's servants who attended him said, 'Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king.'" He says, well, this is a great plan, king. Yes, you don't have a queen right now, but we're going to get you another one. So verse 3, "And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of the kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, into the woman's quarters, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given to them." And so the advisors say, look, it's not good for you, king, to be alone, and so we're going to find you another queen. And the way that we're going to do that is we're going to hold a beauty contest. But it's not going to be any ordinary beauty contest. We are actually going to go throughout all your empire, and we're going to find the most beautiful young virgins that are around. And we're going to have them all come in. And we're going to give them beauty preparations. And the word beauty preparations actually in the original language can actually mean like a polishing. We're going to polish them up. We're going to get them all souped up for you, king, so that you can pick among them the most beautiful one. And she can be your next queen. And so in verse 4, "Then let young women who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. And this thing pleased the king, and he did so." Well, of course it pleased the king. I mean, here he is going to be able to choose the next queen among all the most beautiful young virgins in the land. And the next queen was to be chosen among them. And then we see the people being introduced. These are the main characters that will show themselves throughout the rest of the book. So far, we've only been pretty much introduced to Ahasuerus and Vashti and his advisors. But beginning in verse 5 and through verse 8, we see through verse 7, we see Esther and Mordecai being introduced. And it says in verse 5, "In Shushan the citadel there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite." Now, there's a couple things to note about Mordecai. First of all, apparently he was already in the royal guard of some kind. Now, whether or not he was an advisor of some kind, or whether he was in some way, like a butler or a doorkeeper. We don't know exactly what his role was, but he was allowed in the palace. He was allowed in Shushan, the citadel. This was the place that the king lived. And so Mordecai was already in a position somewhat to be able to have some influence. Now, his name means Marduk, or worshiper of Marduk. Marduk was a pagan god of the Babylonians. It was very customary for the Jews, when they were taken captive by the Babylonians, to be given new names. If you remember Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the three, Daniel was given a new name, and then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that we always refer to, those were actually not their Hebrew names. Those were the names that were given to them by the Babylonians. And so when they were taken captive, oftentimes their Jewish name was replaced with a Hebrew name that would be more in line with their life there. Secondly, we know that he was a resident for a long time. It says that in verse 6, Kish had been carried away. So Kish was his great-grandfather, I guess it is. And he was taken from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. Now, he was obviously among the best of stock, because we read from places in 1 Corinthians and other places, 2 Kings chapter 24, verse 14 and so forth, that those who were considered to be quality people, I don't know how they make those designations, but rulers always make decisions about who quality people are, who are not. But they left the poor people, basically, in the land, and they took all with them those who had potential. And so Mordecai's great-grandfather, Kish, was one of those who had potential, and he was carried away with Jeconiah when the Babylonians came and brought him back to the land. And so he had some deal of lineage there, and he had been a resident for a long time. And so it's not as though he is this Jew who has been displaced. He was born and raised. Mordecai was born and raised in Shushan. That's all he had known, was the Babylonian Empire. And so I think in the context, we have to understand that the Jews in Babylon at this time that Mordecai lived had a challenge like the rest of us do in our day. And that is, how do you live a godly life in the midst of a bunch of pagans? And that's what Mordecai was trying to deal with in those decisions. And so when we see him acting out accordingly, we have to understand that he is doing so in that context. And then verse 7, it says, and Mordecai had brought up Hadassah. Now, Hadassah was her Hebrew name. Later on, she's called Esther. Whether she got that name when she was included among the harem, or whether she got that name earlier on by those who lived in the land, we don't know. But a couple of things to note about her. First of all, is her name Hadassah had been changed to Esther. Hadassah means myrtle, beautiful, fragrant tree of the Middle East. Esther was a Persian name that means star. And Esther was derived from the Akkadian name that means Ishtar, the Mesopotamian goddess of war, of love, and of planet Venus. Now, I don't know how you become a god of war and love, you know, but they seem like contradictory things, but that's the way the pagans were. And so you have her name being changed. She was also an orphan, it says, for she had neither father nor mother. Now, she did, but they had passed away, obviously. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So she was adopted. And I think it's also interesting to note, because this will be playing more importance as we come along, is that she was also very beautiful. Now, I don't know how your text describes it. Mine says that she was lovely and beautiful. If you look at the original language, basically what this means is it says that she was a fine form and a good-looking face. Now, there are some who have good form and others who have a good face, but she had both. She had a good form and a good face. So she was very, very beautiful. And so it's not surprising then that she was chosen among those young virgins of the best in looks. And I think this brings us to another lesson that I think is somewhat tangentiary, and yet it was also important for us to consider, and that is, good looks open doors in this world. It's not the way we would necessarily like it to be, but that is the reality. Esther must have been incredibly beautiful to be preferred above all the most beautiful of the beautiful. As a result, it opened doors for this humble orphan girl to be chosen to be the next queen in the most powerful empire of the world at the time, and to save her people. Why is it that movie stars, particularly those who are the most beautiful of movie stars, are asked their opinion on all different kinds of things. Have you ever wondered that? They'll ask, you know, some Britney Spears or something about her understanding of foreign policy. Like she has any clue of foreign policy. But why do they ask her? Because she's pretty, right? I mean, I guess. I don't know who Britney Spears is. We play this game at home. We just started doing this trivia game. And I do really, really good on all of them but entertainment. And I can't seem to answer any of the entertainment questions. And, you know, they're almost always about Britney Spears or, you know, one of these. And but it doesn't always seem the case that they always ask these Hollywood movie stars questions about world politics and about, you know, feeding the hungry and all these kinds of things when, you know, they may be starred in a movie that had some deal about hunger or something. And so they think, why? Because beauty opens doors in this world. And I once read that they did some investigations as to what made the most successful Hollywood actors and actresses. And of course, it was their beautiful face. And they did some investigations as to what made the most beautiful face in Hollywood. These are like the Julia Roberts for the girls and the George Clooney's for the guys, right? And you know what they found out? It was perfect symmetry. That their face was perfect in symmetric. I mean, there was, you know, everything was in balance. Everything, you know, well, not so much with me. I don't know. You probably haven't looked close at my face, which is a good thing. But I do on a regular basis because I, you know, have to look myself in the mirror, right? Well, did you know that my nose is crooked? It happened one time when I was boxing with my brother growing up, and, you know, he hit me too hard and my nose got crooked. One ear is actually bigger than the other ear. My eye, one of my eyes is lower than the other eye. So when I wear glasses, you know, when I put my glasses up, because my ears are funny and my eye is funny, they don't fit right. You know, my bottom teeth are crooked. Okay, I do not have the symmetric facial expressions that are designed to be a George Clooney look. But looks open doors. Now, this is not to say that if you're not beautiful, doors won't be opened. God gives each of us certain gifting. Some people are gifted athletes. That opens doors. Some people are gifted beautifully, and that opens doors. Some people are gifted in being able to manage things, and that opens doors. And some people are gifted in other ways. And some of us just have kind of a mediocre ability to, you know, pretty much things and never really excel as much in anything. And that's our gifting. Okay? And so it's not to say that just because you're not beautiful, it doesn't open doors, because God is able to open doors in other ways. But I think it is important to note that appearances matter. In 1 Samuel chapter 16, verse 7, if you recall that passage, it is when they're trying to decide upon the next king of Israel. And all the people of Jesse's household are brought before Samuel. But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature, because I have refused him." This is the largest of all Jesse's children. And the idea would be, well, he's the biggest. In appearance, he ought to be the king, right? It says, "For the Lord does not see as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." Now, we are told that God is the one who creates us the way that he does, and so there is a purpose behind the way that we look. There is a purpose in our designing. And we have to come to grips with that. If we're not extraordinary physically, then that's the way God made us. And we have to come to grips with that and understand that and accept that. With that being said, we must balance the truth that God made us the way that he did, and yet at the same time, we have to do the best with what we have. Practically, then, there are some important applications, especially for young people, that I think it's important for us to understand. One thing is that we cannot change our appearance when it comes to hard characteristics like the size of our nose, the shape of our face, or other things. And God made us who we are, but at the same time, we have to do the best with what we have. We can present ourselves rightly, and so, you know, we can take care of our bodies and be physically fit. We can avoid unattractive appearances. I have been told that there is a trend of, I don't want to step on toes, although I probably will by some of the stuff that I'm saying, but, that's kind of the way it is, and I don't think it might be a problem here with these people that are in front of me right now, but maybe with some of you that are you have children or grandchildren or something, you can probably experience this. But there is a trend of tattooing the body. And, you know, the Bible, some people claim the Bible says you can't tattoo your body. I don't think we can argue that from the scriptures. But I will argue this. In the business world, a tattooed body does not open doors. It closes doors. Why? Because of the appearance. And so we have to be careful of that. Being unkept and ungroomed. Now, I say all that in this. I tried to get my hair cut done this week. And the place I go to was closed. The barber was sick, and so I wasn't able to get my hair combed. So excuse the, you know, my mop on my head that needs to be cut and trimmed. We can dress appropriately and fittingly so that we might appear rightly in our situations. We can present ourselves appropriately on social media. Now, again, this probably doesn't relate to you too much, but it might to your grandchildren. You might be able to pass on some tips to them. But, you know, there are a lot of young people that are looking for work. And did you know that employers will go to social media and look at what they're posting on social media? And when a young person posts themselves after a hangover on a Saturday morning, saying, "Oh, what a rough night," and they look like death rolled over, not a very good way to present yourself to a business world, is it? And so, although we can't change our physical features that much, there are things that we can do to make sure that we don't close the doors unnaturally. And I think that that is something that we can consider. Now, I also think there's another point with this, though, and that is that just because a door is opened doesn't mean that we should walk through it. Now, I'll leave this up to you because my wife and I had some discussion about this already. We couldn't come to agreement on this, but as we read this, I want you to consider for yourself whether or not Esther and Mordecai should have taken the actions that they took, or whether they should have tried to do something different. And you can decide that on your own. But just because the door is open doesn't mean that you should walk through it. So let us balance our acceptance with the way that God has made us, at the same time do the best that we can with what we have. This principle can apply not just with looks, but with other gifting and ability that we possess by the Creator. And let us use wisdom and His Word to determine what doors to open, what doors that are open we should pass through. And then in verses 8 through 11, what we see is the preparations being made then to develop these potential candidates for a queen. And in verse 11 it says, "So it was, when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the woman." Now, a couple of points about this. Josephus, who is a historian of the first century and earlier, he tells us that there were about 400 women that were taken among these. And Esther was one of those 400 that was taken. And they were placed under the custody of Haggai. Of course, he would be the only appropriate one to take care of 400 of the most beautiful women in the thing, being a eunuch. And so he was able to take care of them, it says, and they were given places in the custody of the women. And in verse 9 it says, Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor. Now this reminds me of somebody else in the Old Testament. If you recall, everywhere that Joseph went, and every place that he went, every person that he came in contact with, for the most part, it says that he found favor with them, because the hand of God was upon him. Now, what's interesting in the book of Esther is that nowhere is the name of God mentioned. And yet, when we see the details being worked out in the book of Esther as they are, we can't escape the fact that God's hand is in it. And so I think when it says here that they found favor, or she found favor with Haggai, and she finds favor with all who see her, I think that is because the hand of God is upon her. And so in verse 9 it says, "Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor. So he readily gave beauty preparation to her besides her allowance." So in addition to what she would normally receive along with all the 400 other virgins, she was given extra ointments and extra perfumes because he had already decided this was the one for the king. Then 7 choice maidservants were given her, provided for her in the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the woman. So you can see he's already selecting her out to be the one that is going to go before the king and please him. And so she is finding favor already with Haggai, who is going to be in charge of them. Verse 10 says, Esther had not revealed her people or her family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal. This is a repeated phrase. And we find that they are secretly going about this plan without revealing who they are in this. Now, this thickens the plot. We're not told why Mordecai had told her not to reveal her nationality. We will see that there are some anti-Semites in the palace and in Persia at the time, and it's perhaps because of this that they do not reveal their identity. It is significant, though, that since to keep her national identity secret, Esther would have had to eat unclean foods. She would have had to participate in ceremonies that were considered out of bounds for Jews of the day. The situation made it impossible for a faithful Jew to hide her ethnicity and her heritage while still fulfilling the obligations of the law. If you remember, this is in contrast to Daniel. Remember Daniel? Daniel was among the leaders, and it was told that they were no longer to pray. And what does he do? He continues to pray. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were given certain foods, right? And they said, we can't eat these foods. And they were resistant. Daniel was resistant to the laws of the land. They were not following along with it because they were wanting to keep Jewish. But Esther, on the other hand, and Mordecai, they go along with it. And so this is why I'm saying it's not quite as clean as we would like. And yet, as we'll see momentarily, God's hand is in it all. We wonder why they made the decisions that they made. What good Jewish parent would want their daughter to sleep with an uncircumcised pagan king as part of the king's test drive for a new wife? That's really what's going on. And yet, they allow it. I don't know if they had another option. It might have been death if they chose not to cooperate. And yet, they go along. And so in verse 11, we see some tenderness taking place. Every day, Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Every father, every mother knows the challenge of letting your child go and wanting to find out what's going on. And so Mordecai paced back and forth for any news of what is taking place with Esther because he loved her and was concerned about her. And then in verses 12 through 14, what we find is all of these virgins giving their turn to be presented before the king. In verse 12, it says, each young woman's turn came to go into the king Ahasuerus after she had completed her 12 months preparation according to the regulation for the women. For thus were the days of their preparations appointed, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying the women. Now, it's very clear that the expressions that are designed here is that this going into the king was designed to be a kind of a test drive for the king to see whether or not they were going to be suitable queen. This 12-month preparation that each one was to go through was extensive. It talks about oil of myrrh. This is a scented oil that was highly valued as a body lotion. Perfumes were given to them. The Persians, by the way, were very famous for their spices and their perfumes. It became a regular part of their trade all over the world. One commentator says this, the preparations would have involved elaborate beauty treatments, a prescribed diet, and courses in court etiquette. The women's beauty preparations would have begun with a ritual bathing to cleanse the skin. As part of the cleansing procedure, the maiden would have applied a beautifying paste designed to lighten the skin color and remove spots and blemishes. She would have had used a cosmetic burner, which saturated not only the woman, but also her clothes with the fragrance of incense. This process would have been repeated for months. Next, the woman would have been required to remove all excess body hair, including her eyebrows. Her hands and feet would have been painted with henna, an art form known as mehendi, that was popular in ancient Persia and often performed as part of a pre-marriage ritual. And finally, the maiden would have applied facial makeup and perfumes. I mean, this is a big deal. I mean, you think about the preparations that go on to a Miss America pageant or a Miss Universe pageant and all the preparations that goes into that. This is even more so, to have one night with the king. Myrrh, of course, was a scented oil that was usually rubbed on as a preparation for marriage. In verse 13 it says, "Thus prepared, each young woman went into the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the woman's quarters to the king's palace." So this would have included jewelry, it would have included aphrodisiacs, it would have included certain kinds of clothing, whatever it was that they thought would be most useful to win their affection to the king, they were allowed to bring in before the king. Verse 14, it says, "In the evening she went in, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women to the custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who kept the concubines." So obviously the implication is here that they were no longer virgins. Now they're concubines for the king. And it was very common in Oriental culture for kings to have many concubines. We know even of Solomon, who had, 300 wives, 700 concubines, I think the scriptures say. And so this was very customary. And of course, this was indicated. "She would not go into the king again," it says in verse 14, "unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name." This is a sad state for these young girls. One commentator says it this way: "Life for these concubines was more like widowhood than marriage. Although they lived a life of luxury, the inhumanity of being in a harem took an emotional toll on them. They would rarely be allowed outside the palace. They would be limited in contact with their family, perhaps only communicating through messengers. Any child that was born as a result of their service to the king would have been trained to work in the palace and viewed as illegitimate. The lives of these women were taken away simply to provide the king with one night of pleasure." Now that's the situation that we're dealing with here with Esther. And so in 15 through 18, we see Esther, though, being promoted as the queen. Verse 15, "Now when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised." Well, so she's wise here, right? Haggai has been the eunuch for in service to the king all of his life, pretty much. He knows the king intimately. Haggai had set apart Esther pretty much as the one chosen already. And Haggai gives Esther advice and says, "Look, this is what the king is going to want. Take this." Esther goes along with it and says, "Okay." She just takes with her only what Haggai requested. And the custodian of the women advised, and Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So again, we see the hand of the Lord being involved in this. Just like Joseph was able to find favor with all who saw him, so Esther is able to find favor. Verse 16. "So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign." This is in December or January of 479, 478. This is 4 years since Vashti fell out of favor. So the king's been without a queen for 4 years, and he is looking desperately for a queen. Verse 17, "The king loved Esther more than all the other women." Now, we have to understand the love here, the word is not like a romantic love, fairy tale type love that we would see in a Disney movie. The word love here means basically preferred. So he preferred Esther over all the other 399 women that were gathered. Verse 17, "The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the other virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all of his officials and servants. And he proclaimed a holiday in the province and gave gifts according to the generosity of the king." So this is the marriage ceremony. They're having a marriage ceremony here, and they have a great party and extend privileges to the community and probably release a day of taxes. That's kind of the understanding here when it says they gave a holiday, provinces, and gave gifts. So he's celebrating the new wife here with Esther being chosen. And then in verses 19 through 23, what we see is we see some foreshadowing taking place. And this will come in play, more importantly, later on in the book of Esther. But it's important to outline it, what takes place now. So verse 19 says, when the virgins were gathered a second time. Now, this is a very, very challenging phrase. And if you want some homework sometime, you can go home and look up what is meant by this. I tried to find out in commentaries what is actually meant by the second time that these virgins came in. I can't come up with a good conclusion. So whatever time this is, we know that Mordecai sat within the king's gate. It said, now Esther had not revealed her family or her people, just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. In those days, while Mordecai sat with the king within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on the gallows. So they find out about this assassination plot that is going to take place, or is planning and plotted against the king. And so Mordecai finds out about, tells Esther. Esther then goes to the king, tells the king. The king sends out his FBI agents. The FBI agents say, yep, indeed, it was a plot against assassination against the king. And they find Bigthan, and they find Teresh, and they hang them on the gallows. Now, the gallows was a form of hanging where they would sharpen a big, long stick, and they would plunge that stick through the chest of the people and then hang that stick out for everybody to see. Not the most pleasant form of death. And so we'll find the gallows later on in the scriptures also as we read this passage. But here what we find is we find these two that were causing this assassination plot found out. And then what's very interesting is the last phrase or the last verse of the chapter, because it highlights what's going to take place later on. And it says, and when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on the gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Well, so what? So he records it in his journal. Well, that plays a very significant role later on that we'll see. And that brings up, really, the last and final lesson, I think, and probably the most important lesson that we can glean from this chapter, and that is that the hand of God is at work in seemingly worldly events. The hand of God is at work in seemingly worldly events. I want you to consider the following. The lustful desire of a king to have a harem and a new queen is used by God to elevate Esther and Mordecai. The shady decisions of Esther and Mordecai to cooperate with the abusive plan and conceal their identity allows her to become queen. Esther, of all of the 400 virgins, a Jew, was the one who was the most attractive to the king, which put her into position as queen. The assassination plot of the two palace eunuchs just happened to be overheard by Mordecai, who happened to be on the gates or near the gate at the time, who happened to have connections to Esther, who happened to be able to be the queen, who happened to be able to tell the king about the plot. And then, of course, in the last verse, chapter 2, this all happens to be recorded in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings. Life is not black and white, and the situations that we encounter very often, when we look at them, we have a difficulty making the decisions that we make. Not all the decisions are good, and yet God uses them for good. The mystery of the sovereignty of God's providence is that God does not interfere in the decisions of men, but He uses the decisions of men to accomplish His will. Can God use the corrupt worldly events to accomplish what He wants? Absolutely. Can God use the stupid decisions of people to accomplish what He wants? Absolutely. You see, we must not lose heart. We must trust God. He is not absent. Even though His name is not in the book of Esther, the reality of His sovereignty and His providence is all over it. Is He at work in the situation of ISIS right now? Yep, He is. Is he at work in the decisions that President Obama is making or other political figures around the world are making even now? Yes, he is. So who is the hero so far in the book of Esther? Is it Mordecai? Is it Esther? No, you know who the hero is? And I think, in fact, if we try to look for a hero in Mordecai or Esther, we're going to be confused. And as we go along, we'll see in the story even more so that there's this give and take among them that's just really a challenge to try to find a hero in them. And that's the way life is. If we try to find a hero in all the men of the Bible, we won't find it. Who is the hero of the Bible? God. That's the hero of the Bible. Who's the hero in your life? It's God. He's the one working out all the intimate details of your life so that at the end, the result will be what he wants. That's incredible. And yet that's the providence of God. That's a God who is worthy of our praise and our service. Wouldn't you agree? Let's pray.
What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? Just like the plant that withers away, we will leave many seeds behind. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? Change your legacy. What will you do to change your legacy?